You're listening to Underground History, a collaboration between Jefferson Public Radio and the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, or SULA. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose, and each episode we take a deep dive into little-known aspects of history in our region and beyond. On today's show, we're going to chill out with Lisa Baril, science writer who focuses on the emerging field of ice patch archaeology, which is the subject of her new book, The Age of Melt: What Glaciers, Ice Mummies, and Ancient Artifacts Teach Us About Climate Change, Culture, and a Future Without Ice. Lisa, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah, I'm so excited to talk with you today. I've never worked in ice. I've worked when it's snowing. But like everyone, I mean, I've been so fascinated with the Iceman Ötzi. How do you pronounce it? I'm probably saying it wrong.
Ötzi.
Okay. And I'm also really obsessed with the frozen ships from the Franklin expedition. I named my cats after them. But how did you get into this? You're not an archaeologist, right? But probably an honorary ice patch archaeologist by now.
Yeah, I feel like I am a bit of an honorary ice patch archaeologist, although I have to say that throughout my travels, I never found anything of interest. Just fragments that didn't really look like anything to me and turned out to be nothing, but I tried. I'm a wildlife biologist by training, and I studied birds for many years, but I've been living in mountain environments for about 20 years now, and I just am enthralled with mountain landscapes and the ice and snow capped peaks of the highest elevations. And a few years ago, I had read an article about an artifact that was found just outside of Yellowstone National Park, where I live, and it had melted out of an ice patch 10,000 feet in elevation. And this artifact was an ancient hunting weapon called an atlatl, or a throwing spear. And it turned out to be 10,300 years old. And I was just amazed that this organic, you know, artifact made of wood normally would decay in a few years, but it had been sort of captured in time in this ice patch for more than 10,000 years. So I did a little bit of research, and I came to discover that this is a phenomenon that is occurring all over the world. And I was hooked from there on.
Yeah. And, you know, you said this in your book as well, with talking about Ötzi and some of his weapons, that, you know, we archaeologists, we find the rocks. We don't usually find the organic material. So we kind of have to, like, just in our minds engineer what it would look like. So to actually see, oh, here is the complete tool, is so cool. You know, so how neat that that kind of caught your attention.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the most unique aspects of ice patch archaeology is that you're right, most archaeologists are working with stones and bones and things that normally don't decay. And the unique thing about ice patches is that they preserve these organic remains. And it's not just wood, but it's leather. Leather shoes have emerged out of ice patches, skis in Norway made of wooden planks. Sinew that's used to, it's animal tendon and ligaments that's used as sewing material for fabrics in ancient times, bird feathers, you know, just like grass capes and just things that archaeologists and anthropologists normally, like you say, would have to just kind of use their imaginations to see how they would be put together. And ice patch archaeologists don't have to do that because oftentimes the entire weapon or whatever it is emerges whole, like it had just been placed there days ago.
Man, I'm jealous. I guess that makes up for them having to work in freezing conditions. But, you know,
yeah, well,
go ahead.
Well, I was going to say the interesting thing about ice patch archaeology is that these archaeologists are going into the mountains in late summer when their ice is at its lowest extent. So it's really the nicest time of year to be in the mountains. They want to go when the ice patches are at their smallest extent so that the artifacts are melting out of, you know, the edge of the ice and before the snow falls in come winter. So yeah, it still is a harsh environment though.
But you got to find that sweet spot. Yeah. I guess it's kind of exciting to be an ice patch archaeologist right now for two reasons. Number one, there's stuff coming out all the time, which is exciting, but also alarming. But also we have all these tools in our toolkit, like isotopic analysis, DNA. So now they can really kind of get into the nitty gritty about what these either people or things mean and how it can tell us about the past.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the tools that archaeologists can employ now are just so amazing. I mean, when with UTSI. It's going on 30 years since he was discovered, and there are scientists who devoted their whole careers to studying this one mummy and his artifacts, his tools that he went into the mountains with all kinds of the new emerging technologies. You know, they were able to determine what he had for his last meal, and based on pollen grains that he ingested as he went up and down the mountain, they were able to tell, map out his travels. And so it's absolutely remarkable.
Yeah, and that not only humanizes him, but also, it's kind of been used by leverage for the politics of where he was found, right? Because who owns that discovery?
Well, right. He was found right on the border of Austria and Italy. And initially, they thought, the folks that had found him and extracted him thought that he had been on the Austrian side. Turns out he was just a few meters into Italy. And so that caused a lot of controversy of, who owns this person? Of course, there were no country borders when he was living and traveling through the mountains. And so it does speak to, who owns these artifacts? And, I mean, they really are just like a world resource, a cultural resource for everyone, I think.
Yeah, I think so, too. You're listening to Underground History on the Jefferson Exchange. You can find us online at jeffexchange.org. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose, and today I'm joined by the very cool Lisa Burrill to discuss her recent book, The Age of Melt. So in your title, you kind of suggest that there's a world without ice coming, and this not only will have catastrophic impacts on sea levels and ocean temperatures and all that kind of stuff, but also things won't be frozen and preserved. So is that something that people, like archaeologists, are kind of freaking out about? Or what's kind of the scuttlebutt on that?
There are not that many ice patch archaeologists in the world. There may be a dozen and probably a few more than that. But it's really a niche field that has arisen over the last 30 years. And they have such a narrow window to go and find these artifacts, not only within the year, but over time, too, because as the ice continues to melt, and it's happening rapidly, the artifacts are emerging. And because they are organic, they only have a few years to go and find them and recover them before they're lost. And because they're embedded in the ice, they have to go back year after year. So there is a big sense of urgency that these archaeologists have of getting into the mountains, collecting these artifacts, and really triaging these ice patches to get as much information from them as they can before they do melt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, I guess, too, things I remember in your book, too, it talked about when they recovered the Iceman, it stunk. Like, he was actively decomposing as he was melting because he'd been frozen, which is different than a mummy that's, desiccated. The preservation
that's seems
right. Like it's more acute. You got to really stop that decomposition.
Yes, you do. And so with UTSI, he is preserved in a museum in Italy, and he's kept frozen. So these objects are kept frozen because that's the way that they were preserved for so long. And he needs to be frozen and sprayed down with water every now and again to keep him moist so that he doesn't decay any further.
Wow.
And it really is difficult for scientists to actually study him because he needs to remain frozen. But then it's difficult to take samples from frozen remains and all that. But yes, these objects do start to decay pretty quickly, especially in mountain environments. They're really harsh. The sun is intense. There's lots of wind, and there's not much soils up there. So it's not like these objects are going to get reburied and preserved in the soils that way.
Yeah, and it's extreme condition. Like, it's melty, and then it's cold and melty. I know that that's especially hard on artifacts and organic material.
That's right. Yeah, that's a great point. That these it's going from wet to dry to wet to dry, and it's they're exposed to a lot of different things. So it's just kind of and they're fragile.
Yeah.
So
I'm of the X-Files generation, so I have to ask you this, and maybe as your biology background, are other things melting out of the ice too? Like, not necessarily aliens, but other life forms, or not necessarily cultural artifacts, but like artifacts of different species and things that are, getting scientists are discovering?
Absolutely. I am a huge fan of the X-Files, too. I used to love watching that show. And so, when I read about some of the other things that were emerging from ice patches, I was really amazed. For example, in Tibet, some scientists several years ago had gone to the Tibetan Plateau and extracted an ice core. several ice cores probably, and came back with hundreds of viruses. Some of them were new to science, and some of them could be reanimated. These were bacteria and viruses that had lain frozen in the ice for many thousands of years, and they could be reactivated upon thawing. And so that was just amazing to me. And then on the larger scale, there are woolly mammoths, cave bears, cave lions that have been found melting out of ice that are extraordinarily well preserved.
Yeah, we need Mulder and Scully to keep on top of those viruses, I think. But
that's right, I know.
One thing I read, and I tried to find this article again, I'm not an ice patch archaeologist, so I don't know all the details, but I think I just read one of those kind of catchy headlines where it's like, scientists baffled, and it was talking about how the melt of the ice melt is so unprecedented and so happening so rapidly that scientists are actually, things are happening that are unexpected. Like, I think what this article was saying, that the floating ice made a berm, which actually was not going to make sea level rise like they expected. Does that ring any bells to you?
You know, I haven't read that study. I'm not familiar, but I do know that the melt is happening extraordinarily fast, and it's like, It's sort of a vicious cycle, because the warmer it gets, the faster the ice melts, and the faster it goes around and round in circles. So yeah, but I'm not familiar with that particular study.
Yeah, I wish I could remember the details, but I guess it's all new. We'll just see what happens. But yeah. So what do you think about it's thinking about biology and stuff, but it's kind of interesting to shift our view from, you know, we all know if we live in mountains or, you travel and you see mesas and stuff, we kind of understand that those are ancient geological formations. But right now, in this moment, we are like watching that happening in real time, like the impacts on the landscape of added water and melted ice and all those kind of things. Is that something that you think about, and how to kind of anticipate what our world can look like in the next generation without ice?
Yeah, I do think about that quite a lot. A few years ago, in Yellowstone National Park, we had this huge flood. We got a lot of snow over Memorial Day weekend, and then it warmed up really quickly. And it just wreaked havoc on the towns surrounding the national park because of the flooding that came off of these mountains. I mean, the mountains in all over the world are the water towers of the world. They are responsible for storing a lot of our fresh water that we need throughout the year. And when we have not only less snowpack, but warmer spring temperatures, which causes flooding, we have not only just the extreme damage that causes, but that water is just, it goes downriver and out into the oceans unused because it's just coming off so rapidly that people can't capture it.
Yeah. Ugh, that's kind of terrifying to think about. And I hate to end on that note. So what do you think is like, what's a really positive thing that's coming out of, like, what are we learning with all these people really paying attention right now? I mean, this is a diminishing resource, but, they're capturing as much data. So what's your favorite thing that people have learned?
You know, I think that we can't rewind the clock to a time before human-caused climate change. We're in it now. But I think ice patch archaeology is a great way to get people to sort of think about the human connection to climate change. And we think about it all the time, I suppose, with floods and people being affected in real time. But we don't think about it a lot as in terms of our past, and that people have dealt with climate change for as long as humans have been on this planet. And we have been able to adapt to different climate changes. And I think this is one more, probably our biggest problem, and a bigger problem than we've ever faced before. But humans are really smart, ingenious, and I think that, I have a lot of faith in humanity that we can figure this out and turn the tides.
Thank you so much, Lisa, for joining us, for writing this book. Pick up your copy of The Age of Melt. That wraps up this round of Underground History on the Jefferson Exchange. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose. Our show producers are Natalie Gallet and Charlie Zimmerman. You can find this episode and much, much more at jeffexchange.org or wherever you get your podcasts.